fame at any age can be challenging to handle, as Tama Jenowitz recounts in her memoir, Scream, a memoir of glamour and dysfunction. She spent her 20s and 30s as a member of the so-called Brat Pack writers that included Bret Easton Ellis, Mark Lindquist, and Jay McInerney. She also hung out with the likes of Andy Warhol, Lou Reed, Debbie Harry, and partied regularly at Studio 54. In this, her 11th book, she writes about what it was like to hang out in downtown Manhattan in the 1980s, aging, being a parent, and watching her own mother die after an extended period of dementia. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased it has brought Tama Jenowitz back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
How old were you when your short story collection, Slaves of New York, was published?
Let's see. It came out in 86, and they had started to come out, some of them, in The New Yorker before that. I don't know, my mid-20s.
Were you prepared to become kind of famous overnight?
No, not in the slightest. I had written one book, American Dad, and it sold very, very few copies. And then I was just publishing in small literary magazines and downtown newspapers. And all of a sudden, when those stories came out in The New Yorker, I suddenly had an audience of readers. And The Slaves of New York was on the cover of New York Magazine, and everything changed. I had always been quite paranoid, but now people were whispering about me, and they really were.
They were talking about you behind your back. Well, how did you get published in The New Yorker? It's not so easy to break through.
It was a strange experience because, of course, it's a huge, huge breakthrough, especially in those days when Mr. Sean was the editor-in-chief of the magazine. I mean, I just sent stories in over the transom, and then they accepted them.
One critic described you as being part of, quote, a wave of young minimalist authors whose wry, urbane sensibility captured the zeitgeist of the time. Is zeitgeist a key word in that description?
I mean, I'm not sure, and I certainly don't think of myself as a minimalist. The stories were mad, crazy, hectic about what it was like to be a young person in New York City at that time, and Soho that back then was just still really working factories, knitting factories, pin-making factories. You could still get a cheap apartment.
You could still get a cheap apartment in New York.
Yeah.
Period.
Right, exactly. People were still able to come to New York and work in a coffee shop or a coffee shop and pay for rent. And it was still a city separated by uptown and downtown. And it was a very different city than the city I see today.
Let's talk about that a moment. For example, you have Lena Dunham doing a show about young women coming to New York and trying to survive as single women in Brooklyn. You lived in Brooklyn for a while. So the experiences she has on her show are totally different from the ones you had?
Well, of course, I don't really know. I don't know what it's like to be a young person arriving in the city today, but it looks like a very different town. And we still had all these marginal neighborhoods. I lived in the meatpacking district, and that's, I don't know what it is today, but back then it was where meat was delivered, and I had an apartment that was 10 by 12 feet, and I actually measured it. I'd always been afraid of going to jail for some reason, but then one day I measured that apartment, and I looked around, and I thought, big deal, if I end up in jail, I'll have a bigger cell than I do here. And the meat was delivered in these huge trucks at dawn, and the streets were covered with rats and pigeons all eating these carcasses. That's where I did the cover of New York Magazine. I went into a meat locker, and they photographed me in there.
And now the Whitney Museum is in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
You were born in San Francisco, and your father was a psychiatrist, your mother an accomplished poet and English professor. How old were you when they divorced?
I was about 11, and I was living in a small town in western Massachusetts, and at that time, parents did not divorce. It was still old New England, like the Scarlet Letter, and other kids my age said, come and play with me today. No, I can't. Well, why not? Because my parents say you came from a broken home.
Ooh.
I mean, times were just so, so different.
Your father comes across as kind of awful, and so does your brother, but not your mother, who seems to have been sweet, if a bit eccentric.
My mother was very, very eccentric, very brilliant. Her books were published by various university presses, chosen by Elizabeth Bishop and Maxine Cuman, and she before her marriage had been a dietitian, and then when she got pregnant and after her marriage, then she was fired from her job, because in those days, if you got married, that was a good chance you were going to get fired, and if you got pregnant, you were certainly not going to have a job any longer. So after the divorce, my mother went back to school, got her MFA in poetry at University of Massachusetts, and still was unemployed, because where was a middle-aged woman poet going to find a job? So we survived very, very marginally for very many years. She would teach at a community college one course, and she would teach in a high school or someplace at night. And eventually, through publishing, and she got a grant from the Radcliffe Institute, then the Radcliffe Institute, I think now it's the Bunting Institute. She took me and my brother, age 12 and 10, to live in Israel. We were going to immigrate there, but it was right after the Six-Day War, and so I write about in my book being living in Israel in 68, 69, which was a fascinating time to live in a young country, particularly as a small child.
But you missed all of the political ferment of New York in 1968.
Well, I think I would have been 11 or 12 or something. I mean, yeah. But then I came back to New York after that year in Israel a few years later and went to Barnard College. So I did get to experience New York City of the 70s, which was the city was on the edge of bankruptcy.
Do you think the city might have been different for you if you'd grown up here? You came here as an outsider.
Yes, I came here because when I grew up, and it was in Western Massachusetts, there was a big oil crisis. So all the parents turned the heat off in the houses and I froze to death. But my grandparents lived in Flushing, Queens, and they had an overheated apartment. So we would visit them once or twice a year. And I always thought, when I grow up, I'm going to move here and live in an overheated apartment. So I was determined to come back to the city, and I did. I went to Barnard.
How did you come to meet people like Andy Warhol, who is another transplant?
Well, at the time when I had first moved back to New York again, this was the early 80s, Andy was out in clubs and galleries, and as a person with no money, I found out that you could just take a bus to Soho, walk around, and suddenly there would be a small gallery on the ground floor that was an art opening. Kids were crowded in there. There was free white wine, and I would start to hang out there, and I met Andy just because he was also out and about. He didn't differentiate between what scenes he went to, whether it was the glamorous and posh places uptown like Le Cirque or downtown small art gallery. So I got to first know him in the early 80s. And then in around 1985, I had some writing in Interview magazine. And through a girlfriend, Paige Powell, she one night called up and said she was going out on a blind date that night. And did I want to join her? Which seemed to me very unusual, but I said, sure, why not? I barely knew Paige, and I didn't know why somebody would want me to join them on a blind date. But Andy, Paige Powell, was the advertising director at Interview. Andy overheard her talking about this and said, oh, gee, I really want to come on that. So he came on the blind date. So he brought a few people, too. So it was at the Odeon, me, Paige Powell, Andy Warhol, five of his friends, and this poor blind date who didn't seem to know what was going on. So after that, Andy loved it so much, we did it at least two or three times a week.
Your portrait of him is very different from the man we meet in his diaries.
Well, for one thing, I think the diaries, while terribly well done, were edited to include the information that the author, Pat Hackett, wanted to include, and she was fascinated. He called her every day at about 10 a.m. She was fascinated by where he had gone the night before, who he had seen, and the details of sort of celebrity dumb of New York, whereas the Andy I knew was hysterically funny, rather introspective, interested in all kinds of things, particularly medical issues, psychic stuff. And so I think a lot of that stuff, his humor and his just talking about things other than celebrities, is not in those diaries.
But people want to know about the celebrities, and you hung out with a fair number of them. Also, you've been associated with the Brat Pack, the writers kind of named after the Sinatra Rat Pack. Did you feel like you fit in with them?
Well, I think that was kind of something established by media that was like a way to write about a lot of writers who were writers that were selling books to young people. Young people were going out and buying these books for fun rather than because they were assigned that as a college subject or not like somebody that was just an avid reader. So these books, Slaves of New York, was hitting a big group of people that just wanted to read a book about their reflected world and lifestyle.
You say in the book that you were too afraid to enjoy yourself during those fabulous times?
Well, I think if there would be a piece of advice, I would say, because I've always been frightened and fearful, but nevertheless, I've gone out and done everything. I have been terrified of everything, but I haven't let it stop me. And I mean, if I could do my life over again, I wouldn't be fearful, but that's the person I am. But I think I get extra points because even though I am scared of everything, I did it.
Not everyone was allowed into Studio 54.
No, I was a kid then, and I mean, I was at Barnard, and a whole bunch of us just went over there. And the first night it opened, it had this mob scene outside, and everybody was crowding and rushing to get in. It was the first time I think a nightclub had been like that. Well, I looked around, and I thought, if these are the people I'm standing on the street with, why the heck would I want to be inside with them? So the first night I left. But after that, as a kid, I just went back and hung out in Studio 54, and I mean, there was all this stuff taking place in there, sex and sweaty dancing and cocaine and drugs, and it was fascinating as a kid. And you could at that time go to a nightclub and there was Andy Warhol sitting on a banquette with Nureyev and Bianca Jagger and Truman Capote, and just sitting there, there was no like differentiation between a VIP room and just everybody else.
On the other hand, when I went there, I wasn't necessarily invited to sit at the table.
Well, I don't think you really had to be. It was just a banquet, and if you wanted to go and sit down, Andy was friendly to everybody, and you could just say, hi, Andy, and he'd say, hi, gee, you're really cute, and whatever. I mean, all these different people would meet him, and he was a lonesome person, and he just loved the young people. He loved to see everything about New York, from opera to ballet to art shows, but, I mean, as he grew older, the city began to treat him really hatefully, and I think that happens in this city so much that it has its stars and celebrities, and then the city eats them alive and trashes them. He was considered a used-up middle-aged pop artist, and he was treated very badly. Like, he gave a reading at Rizzoli's of his book America, and some kid rushed up and yanked his wig off. Mm. Sometimes we'd go to clubs like the Limelight, and all of a sudden the bunch of us would gather around him thinking, they're going to kill him. They just are so hostile towards him. And, of course, after his death, he hadn't had a major museum retrospective in his life. He had one small museum retrospective many years earlier. But after his death, of course, that's when his work became so valued and such a commodity, and he was so...
And many people consider him one of the most influential artists of the last 20 years of the 20th century.
Well, I mean, I, in many ways, compare him to Norman Rockwell. Not that his work was the same, but he captured a slice of the United States of America in a way that was different than anybody else had ever done it before.
Another acquaintance of yours was Lou Reed, who was capturing a different kind of slice of America.
Yes, at the time I knew Lou, you know, he was... he had never been a huge, huge commercial success, and certainly in the early 80s, he still wasn't a commercial success, and he didn't have the kind of reputation for being such a major influence.
Well, the Velvet Underground was an influential group.
Yes, it was influential, but small, seminal group that really didn't sell that many records. But as time has gone on, their music has become more and more recognized as being highly influential.
My guest is Tamara Janowitz, who's published 11 books, which have been translated into 22 languages and made into several films. The one we are discussing is a memoir called Scream, a memoir of glamour and dysfunction. It is published by the Day Street imprint of William Morrow. And we will continue a conversation after we take this break. We're back with Tamara Janowitz. Her latest book is Scream, a memoir of glamour and dysfunction, published by William Morrow. How did you meet your husband, Tim Hunt? Because so much of this is about being single in New York.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it was after Andy died and my husband had come to help with the estate sale, thanks to Fred Hughes, who was Andy's manager. And Andy just loved those titled or aristocratic or pretty English boys and girls. Anyway, Paige Powell, my friend, who we had the blind date club with Andy, fixed me up with him one night. And, yeah, we had many good years together.
And you adopted Willow, a girl from China. You have talked before about trying to prepare yourself for the insensitivity of people who would openly question why your daughter had Asian features so different from your own. But by then you were living in Brooklyn, where there are all kinds of children of mixed parentage, and you didn't get much attention after all?
I wrote about that in a Vogue article and also in my other collection of nonfiction, Area Code 212. But they would stop me on the street with my baby in a stroller, and then I would think, uh-oh, here it's coming. They're going to ask why, you know, my kid's Asian. But they said instead, what is wrong with your dog? Because I had these Chinese crested dogs that are supposed to be hairless, but they actually had tufts of fur sticking out all over their body. And people were very, very upset by that. In fact, a Chinese crested was more exotic than having a Chinese baby.
Well, a lot of girls were being adopted from China at that time.
Well,
but
I think it's more
you've
than
had
that.
A lot of dogs.
Yeah, yes, I did. But I think, like, in New York City, you know, even still now that the city is so transformed and seems so homogenized, it's such a great mix of just people from all over the world that have come here. And so nothing is unusual.
How old is your daughter now?
Now she's just about to be 21, and she's doing two semesters over in China. And it's fantastic.
But you've had a lot of dogs, which you write about, and horses as well.
Now I'm living in upstate New York. I finally just didn't find the city to be fun for me anymore. And it became a place that wasn't inspiring me as a writer. Before, I would love to see the people and ride the subway, go to the different neighborhoods, look in the stores, go to the restaurants, once in a while opera, ballet. But then gradually, I did not want to go anymore to the art openings. I felt like I had written about it in the 80s, and I lost interest in all these people trying to say, look at me, look at me, look at me. And also, I got tired of breathing in the same air that everybody else had already gotten to use up before me. So
you moved to Ithaca, where that isn't exactly the country. It's kind of like a mini version of parts of New York.
Now I'm living further away in Schuyler County. And in Ithaca, I went there to look after my mom, who had retired from Cornell. She finally did get a job when she was 50, and she retired when she was 80. But shortly after that, about 1 year later, she began to deteriorate physically. So I left Brooklyn, and my kid came up to go to high school up there. And then after my mother had to be placed in a nursing home, I moved further away from Ithaca, which is an academic town, to Schuyler County, where if you have an old bathtub and you want to get rid of it, toss it out in the woods.
Yeah, I've read about somebody who said that he found his way back home by counting all of the bathtubs that he saw.
That's me on my horse. If I get lost, I just know, find the previous bathtub.
Your mother, as we pointed out, was an accomplished poet, professor of English for 30 years at Cornell in the creative writing department. Did she influence your work? Did you let her edit your work?
Everything, really. She was my first reader, and if I was trying to write a book, she would read it, and she would say, you know, this book starts off really on page 70. That's where it really gets going. She was supportive, not financially, because we never had money, but she would say, look, if this is what you want to do in life, this is what you should be doing. She never said, go and be a lawyer, go get married. She was just, if this is what you want to do, you should do this. And she didn't say, oh, you're a great writer. She just said, keep at it. This is really good. And she always said, look, I don't have money, but I always have an extra room for you to come and stay in, which was always my backup thought.
It's always painful to watch a loved one deteriorate. And you've said in other interviews that this memoir was extremely painful to write because it involved reliving your mother's decline?
Yes, and my mom had been my best friend in the best possible way. We would speak every day. She knew my whole life, so I didn't have to explain things or go into details of who this person was or that person. And she was supportive. I don't know.
But what about your psychiatrist's father? Did you have much contact with him after the divorce?
No. My father started smoking marijuana when I was very little, and it was in the 60s, so at that time it was so tremendously illegal, and I was constantly being threatened that if I ever mentioned this to anybody, even though he was trying to get my brother, to then age 12, to grow pot up on the roof, because it was easier for a little kid to climb up on the roof, which was flat. Anyway, that sentence didn't come out quite right. The point is, no, my dad was not very supportive of me. And I think one thing about marijuana is I don't think it should be illegal, but people don't really understand the effects of long-term addiction to that drug.
I'm more concerned about what it must have been for a patient of your father's come for a therapy session and have him sitting there stoned. Maybe that's why he didn't talk.
I don't know. I know... I know everybody complains about their parents, and I know that it's gone on for thousands of years.
You pick apart your past in this memoir, and there's real honesty about what it was like, but the present doesn't come across as all that much fun either.
Well, I don't know. It's very interesting to try to live in the here and now and the moment, and I think the horseback riding has helped me with that tremendously. The horse doesn't know about yesterday, and it's not looking about tomorrow. It's just in the moment.
Well, after you decided that you didn't want to live in Ithaca anymore, you could have moved back to the city. You would have been a different person moving to a different environment. Why did you decide instead to move into the wilds?
I had grown up in the country, and I don't know if you go back to what you knew to begin with, but I do know that for me right now in my life, the city is not the place for me.
And when you come here, you...
I'm overwhelmed. The streets are so crowded, and I look at things like you have to have passcodes for everything, and I don't know. It's interesting. You just think, what if you had come to the city and you came from the 50 years ago? You know, it's like a science fiction movie.
What do you think about all the social media required of authors today to sell their work? I'm assuming you have Wi-Fi, even though you're in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, yes, I do get the internet and everything. And, I mean, really, there's so few readers, I pray, to find somebody with my sense of humor and with interest in what I'm talking about, which is, it's a black sense of humor. It's quite satirical and ironic. And if I write my memoirs, and I have a lot of strange chapters about, like, the neighbor attacking a shrub, somebody has to get my sense of humor to appreciate my writing about a shrub.
Mm-hmm. Well, you established yourself initially as a short story writer, and there's been a lot of talk over the years about the very thin line between fiction and nonfiction when you're talking about a memoir. Did you write this in the same spirit?
It was difficult because my mom had just died when I started. I was writing chapters, and I was trying to get my way out of her house, which was full of stuff. I wouldn't say she was a hoarder, but I couldn't get to my bed in the bedroom for about 3 years.
And finally, had to climb over?
Yeah. I mean, we collected books. We bought old books. We went to used book sales. We went to the Friends of the Library sale. We bought books and bought books. And my mother would always... And my mother was an avid reader, and she was quite brilliant, and she read biographies of everybody. And anyway, the point is...
Well, we were talking about the thin line between fiction, nonfiction, memoir, and short story.
Yes, at the time in my life, it was painful to write a memoir, but I wasn't trying to transform it into a novel with characters and plot development and more of a storyline. Well, I could just write whatever I wanted to write about, and to me that was whether it was living in New York in the 80s or living in Israel as a kid or whatever I wanted, meeting the Sex Pistols in England in 1976. You know, I was free.
In a memoir, you can tell you don't always have to just show.
Yes, although it's more interesting to show, and I think in my book I wrote about going down to the south of France on invitation from Lawrence Durrell, the writer, because I always wanted to be a writer, and so he had me stay at his place in the south of France.
Well,
and
that
then,
must have been thrilling.
Oh, my gosh. And then he put me on a train and said, go to Paris and stay in this hotel and eat at... go to breakfast at La Coupole. Go there at 9 o'clock and sit in the third line of banquettes from the back and face the door. And at 9:05, you will see Samuel Beckett come in, and he will sit at one table. And at 9:10, Simone de Beauvoir will come in, and she will sit at another table facing Samuel Beckett. And at 9:15, Jean-Paul Sartre will come in. So I went to that restaurant, and I got there at 9, and I ordered a café au lait and croissant, and... then, it, sure enough, at the Times, Samuel Beckett came stumping in, sit down, staring straight ahead. Simone de Beauvoir came in, not speaking to Beckett. Jean-Paul Sartre came in, not another three speaking to each other. And only me, the only other diner, sitting there in this restaurant, age about 19, with complete disbelief. What the heck was I doing in a restaurant with Sartre, Beckett, and Simone de Beauvoir? It was astonishing.
I would have thought you would have moved to Paris after that, because that's even perhaps more exciting than knowing Andy Warhol, Lou Reed, Deborah Harry.
Well, what was I going to do? Sit there and look at them every morning at 9 o'clock in disbelief?
Oh, you could have gone over to one of the tables.
I guess so.
Tamara Janowitz will be speaking with Kat Kinsman, signing books at the Strand Bookstore tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. That's at Broadway and 12th Street. Her memoir is called Scream, a memoir of glamour and dysfunction, published by Day Street, which is an imprint of William Morrow. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you, Leonard.
And I hope you parked your horse outside the station?
Yes.